Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
Roll 'em, Tom. I was asked a question 2 weeks ago. I didn't address it last week because the person who asked the question wasn't here. That was kind of like defeating. So this week I will answer the question. And the question was, what's the similarities or differences between Old Testament baptism and New Testament baptism? Okay, it was a good honest question. The answer in a nutshell is the Hebrew, even all the way back to the Chaldean, never has a word for baptism in the Old Testament. So if you take it as that as a relationship, then there is no similarity and or differences. If the word doesn't appear in the Old Testament, then how can you draw any comparisons? But if you look at the baptism of John and realize what was the intent, I think then as you look back in the Old Testament, you can see maybe parallels. It's not going to be a baptism as we understand baptism, but neither was John the Baptist's baptism a baptism as we understand baptism. The first instance of what we call man's relationship to water, which is how we interpret baptism, occurred at the flood. Because, hey, follow me here and don't like draw conclusions before I do. When John baptized, did it take away anyone's sin? The rest of you go like this. Okay, you got it. No, that water baptism didn't take away anyone's sin. Does the baptism that we're familiar with take away anyone's sin? Okay, so there must be a different reason for baptism. John summed it up and said repentance. We use that in English as an all-inclusive word, but in reality, that word needs to be broken down a little bit. How it was broken down, as I studied about it, was it is a testimony and a dedication of one's person by that person to the Lord. That doesn't take the place of salvation, but it is the precursor for salvation, which then baptism, as we understand it, is a public example of what happened internally, spiritually to us. It's kind of like the water is a symbol of saving us, of preserving us. And the way it's equated in the Old Testament is, yeah, there's a lot of people perished in the water, but 8 souls were preserved by the water. We get baptized, we know we're not saved. We know our salvation's not dependent at all upon baptism. It's just a testimony. But God gave a testimony of water preserving those whom he chose to preserve. Another one was when, and they didn't even get a foot wet, was when the Jews passed through the Red Sea, if you like that better. Waters were separated. The ungodly perished in the waters, but the godly were preserved through the waters. Not saved. We know salvation comes by faith. Hebrews chapter 11, the upstate. Salvation comes by faith. God gives us the faith. And our testimony that God gave us the faith is our baptism. We go along, and in reality, if Bud gets baptized and he stands up and he gives a testimony that God has purified him, look back in the Old Testament, and what were the priests required to do before they offered their sacrifice?
Wash.
In the laver. Okay, I didn't need to give you that hint. Before and after they offered the sacrifice, they had to purify themselves. A ritual purification. Did the water actually make them holier?
No,
absolutely not. But it was a ritual purification, and it showed a dedication of that priest to God. Isn't our baptism showing a dedication, our dedication to our God? And by the way, folks, we're priests. We are kingdom of priests. The Bible tells us that. So there's a parallel. Remember Naaman? N-A-A-M-A-N? What did he have to do to become purified from the disease he had? Wash in the river how many times? Seven times. And he'd be purified. Did the water heal his leprosy? What healed his leprosy?
Faith.
Does our baptism heal our depraved condition? What heals our depraved condition?
Faith.
Absolutely. So can I find the word baptism? I looked it up in Greek. There's two words, baptisto and bap. I get confused. I get tongue-tied with the Greek word. Anyway, either Greek word does not translate into a Hebrew or a Chaldean word that I can find in Scripture. I can't find a Hebrew word for baptism. I can conclude then the word baptism isn't in the Old Testament. But all we can see there is examples of being purified. Aaron, priests, were required to wash themselves before they conducted their holy rituals and rites. That was symbolism of getting off everything that encumbers us and being dedicated to God. Our baptism is a symbolism of getting off that which encumbered us, our sin, and being prepared for God and giving testimony for it. So that's as good as I can do with it, okay? But as for correlation, plenty of examples in the New Testament of a baptisto, but none in the old. I like to try to answer questions. I mean, any question that you have to me is an important question. So don't hesitate to ask me a question, write me a question, email me a question. I may be able to answer it on the spot. I may have to go search for an answer for you. Yes?
Give me 60 more seconds.
Sure.
What then does the What is their expectation of a Catholic baptism of a baby?
Their expectation of a Catholic baptism, and that's not, they're not the only ones, it's not the only church organization that considers Catholic baptism of a baby or an infant washes away the original sin. It's not in preparation for the preserving of that baby's soul for all eternity. It's just that baby's born with original sin, and we have to get rid of that. Well, they consider infant baptism as the way that original sins are removed. Then after that, you can light your candles and have indulgences and everything else for your mortal and venial sins as they come along, okay? So Catholic is only for original sin, which is our inherited sin from Adam and Eve. That's the Catholic doctrine on that, amongst a couple other religions. Our way of understanding and a way we practice, we immerse at baptism. Nowhere in the Latin translation or Greek translation does baptisto in Greek ever mean immersion. So we practice immersion, we require immersion for full membership, but bear in mind, baptism is not described as immersion. Baptism, I understand it, is valid just by pouring or sprinkling, because it's not the water that's doing the job, it's the person that's doing the job. So yeah, I'll be labeled as a heretic against Baptist doctrine ever from now on, but that's just what I find when I study these original words and the definitions. I mean, what else can I go by?
Where it says he went down into the water?
He went down into the water. It didn't say he goes under the water.
Okay.
Yeah. Naaman went down into the water 7 times. It doesn't say he was ever immersed.
It's not.
Yes, Bud.
Or just another note on that baptism in whether it's Catholic or Lutheran or whatever churches. Those churches believe that the spirit of the individual can be baptized into that body, corporate body.
Mm-hmm.
From the time of the infant baptism, that child is protected until he takes until he takes his first Holy Communion, when he's then ushered into adulthood in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so that answers a lot of questions. Why can folks act so loosely with their quote-unquote religion? Because they're being kept, if you will, shirt-tail salvation type stuff. My mom and dad were Lutherans, I'm a Lutheran, we're going to die Lutherans, and God's going to welcome us into heaven because we've taken communion.
Yeah,
at
12 years old you were baptized.
There you go.
Yeah. Roman Catholics have that same thing of first Holy Communion, and what that's actually patterned after is bar mitzvah, and then later enjoined to that was bat mitzvah, okay, for girls. Because they felt left out. So, yeah. None of them does anything for the person. Yes?
Romans 6:4 says, therefore we are buried with him by baptism of death, that like Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we should walk in the newness of life. Does buried mean put under?
Buried means put under, but the Greek word that we translate into English there, and in that sense it is the word baptisto, never means immersion. So we can't.
I'm thinking the word buried.
Pardon me?
I'm thinking the word buried when you're buried.
Buried. Yeah, the Lord was buried.
That's where I thought about
yeah.
immersion.
That's where we get the idea, yeah. But is it, can we be like cynical against those who don't believe that? No, we can't, because there's no hard and fast rule that definitely says you have to be put underwater.
Constitution that says you do. What do you want?
Yeah.
Constitution.
Well, that's only if you want to be a full member here. I don't know how you can sort of be related to a church body, you know, and once you become baptized by immersion, then you can be fully related to a church body. What were they thinking? Surprisingly, Acts 24, the first person in Roman law was the citizen. These are just a couple things to get you going. However, the secret of Roman government was the principle of incorrect rule. They had a set of laws, many which are adopted from basically our beginning of civilization with the Greeks, adopted from the Greeks. First person of importance under law is the person, needs to be protected and everything else. But in practice, The Romans didn't uphold Roman law. And we're going to find out what's happening here this morning as we go into this. We'll see a corrupt Roman system all the way through. I'm going to read the first 9 verses. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus. Down means down in elevation, because Caesarea is northwest of Jerusalem, so it's not up. And they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. Governor here is Felix. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. We have enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in the nation. Everywhere and in every way, most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world, the known world, of course. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. The Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. Jews here, read Asian Jews. These are the ones from Western Asia, the churches that were established on the eastern side of the Aegean Sea. You know what churches? Ephesus, places like that. Remember, Paul didn't have such a real good party time in Ephesus. You know, the riots started up, and you know he
didn't have a lot of places.
No, he didn't have a very good day. Roman law was complex. It was as complex as ours is. And of course, every time Congress convenes, they take on and add a whole bunch of other laws, most of which don't really matter, and I feel so that they don't have to handle the real important issues. But that's the way the Romans were also, so that's what we patterned ours after. You like that, huh? What happened here was Ananias, remember the high priest Ananias, what did Ananias say to the people that were sitting around Paul? Slap him across his mouth. So this is the Ananias, okay? He's already doing things that were not legal by Roman law, which he's a Jew, but he still had to abide by Roman law. If you're from Colorado and you come to New Jersey, you can't just live by Colorado law. Because right now, in Colorado, you can have marijuana. Don't do it in Joycey. Well, if you wait long enough, you can do anything around here. Yeah. We'll follow anybody. Now, to understand the law, to understand the law in our country, you kind of have to have a lawyer. And we talk about when we read something and it's complex and it's intricate, boy, you need to be a Philadelphia lawyer to understand this. Anybody heard that expression before? Okay, so you need an expert. Well, an expert came along with Ananias, and his name was Tertullus. He's a professional lawyer. Did he have any stake in this? No, he's not a Jew. It doesn't matter a nickel's worth to him what the outcome is between Paul and Ananias, or the Jews that were accusing him, or the Asian Jews. He was a man for hire. And unlike the ads today on television for lawyers, we don't get paid unless you get paid. Tertullus and the legal system didn't work like that back then. You paid Tertullus up front to do something, and he'd do whatever you told him for money. So what did Ananias do? Pumped him up with a whole bunch of information and said, you go down to Caesarea and swear to it. And that Tertullus got his marching papers and off he went. And now he's going to testify about about Paul. He doesn't know anything about Paul. He's probably never seen Paul before in his life. And now he's going to bear false witness against this man. Or at least, false witness is born and he's going to swear to it as an official. What does Tertullus do first? Hey, Felix, you know, you are such a good guy. You have done so many wonderful things, and you've kept the peace, and you've done this, and you've done that, and wait, you know, like, trying to get, Tertullus is thinking, I'm trying to get this Felix on my side. Well, if Tertullus was so good, if he kept the order of government in the province, why did it take, last week as we read, 470 soldiers to protect one man on a little trip of 70 miles? Do you ever think about that? I don't think Felix was doing a good job, or it wouldn't take 470 people, army soldiers, to protect him. So there was a lot of unrest in the land. But Tertullus, and Tertullus knows this. But you know, like, the best way to get the judge on your side is take him out to lunch or whatever you can do to sway his opinion toward you. So we see Tertullus bringing three charges, basically, against Paul. Now, I'm not going to read every verse and pick out the charges, but the first thing he says, and we're looking in verse 5, by the way, is that Paul is a troublemaker. Or another translation says a pestilent fellow. Same thing. Person that makes trouble. Paul's going to answer these, so I'm not going to step in and talk about it right at the moment. But the second charge that Tertullus brings is sedition and heresy against the religion. The religion that was authorized by the Romans to be practiced in their kingdom, and that was Judaism. The third thing, again in verse 5, is the charge of desecrating or profaning the temple. It's a doctrinal charge. Was Paul a pest? Well, yeah, in some ways I'd say he was. Yeah, he wouldn't have got a bunch of people stirred up against him. But was he a pest on purpose? No, he rocked the traditional boat. And when people started falling off the traditional boat, then people got upset. So we have a political charge, a personal charge, and a doctrinal charge. Jews were trying to hang on to their ancient traditions. There's nothing wrong with tradition. We have tradition in our church. All religious organizations have their traditions. Nothing inherently wrong with a tradition. Nothing inherently wrong having an order of worship in your bulletin be almost exactly the same as it was last week. Just kind of mixed it up a little this morning, you know? Wonder how many people got upset that we didn't, you know, have the exact same form that we had for the last 900 weeks or more. Traditions are okay. But the Jews were relying on their rites and their traditions for what? Starts with an S. There you go. Salvation. That meant more to them than anything. God would certainly have to smile favorably upon the Jews because they had their traditions. Not necessarily so. If your traditions are an act of your dedication to God by you, then God notices that. But if your traditions are merely to nudge God over to your side, like Tertullus is trying to do to Felix, then that's not right. That's not good. We're going to find out that Felix actually sees through this a little bit. But then again, Felix really didn't want anything to happen that would upset Pax Romana. What's Pax Romana? It's Latin. Roman peace. Okay. They wanted everything to stay quiet. Why? Well, the bigwigs in Rome didn't like to have to put out fires. Instead of putting out a fire, they put out the guy that allowed the fire to start in the first place. So this is this great big posturing game that's being played here. Tertullus accuses Paul of stirring up insurrections amongst all the Jews in the Roman Empire. True or false?
True.
False. Are there Jews in Rome? Has Paul been to Rome yet?
No.
See, not all the Jews, but Tertullus makes this blanket statement. And there's no basis for it, no founding for it. Felix is smart enough to know that Paul hasn't been certain places. And certain problems that have cropped up in with civil disobedience, Paul wasn't even there. So Felix is sorting these things out. But one thing he doesn't want to do is he don't want to get the Jews against him either. So he's trying to please everybody, the Roman government, the Jews. He just wants to keep his job.
And that doesn't work.
And that doesn't work. Now, what were the Jews told to do when they crossed over the Jordan into the Promised Land? What was the command God gave them?
Multiply.
Kill everything you find. Every man, woman, and child and animal that you find in this land, kill it. Purge the land, then take it. Well, how would you like to kill a whole bunch of kids? No. If I was commanded in that era, that's one thing, but I'd get tired of that. So what was the next step then? If you can't beat them, join them. What did Jews do? Make friends. So instead of pleasing God, which is most important, they tried to please themselves and make friends with who would become their enemies. And it's reaping the results today. Look at the unrest in the Middle East. How much unrest would you have in the Middle East if the Jews had gone into the land of promise, Canaan, and killed everything?
There wouldn't be
any Arabs, but there would be some conflicts between Edom and Israel, but nowhere near to the point we have today. So Paul's not guilty of stirring up Jews kingdom-wide, Roman kingdom-wide. And he says here that, let me find it. Verse 5. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among all the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect. Can somebody tell me anything about this, other than Carol, which has already asked me? Somebody tell me something about the Nazarene sect?
Aren't they the ones that didn't cut their hair?
That's Nazarites.
Oh,
okay. Okay.
Were they the ones that believed in the spirit? They have a spirit?
Oh, yeah, they very definitely did.
Yes.
Well, Pharisees believed in life after death,
yeah.
Angels, resurrection. Right. Sadducees did not. Okay.
No.
This is the sect of the Nazarenes. Well, you know, the first thought I had was Nazarite vow. So, we're thinking, who was the first Nazarite? I was thinking.
Samuel.
You can go home this afternoon and thank God that you don't always think like I do. I was thinking who, and it was Samuel. His mother dedicated him, and he was dedicated for life. Who was the next one?
Samson.
Who was the next one? No, you're not stuck.
John the Baptist.
There you go. See, you're not stuck. Don't give up so easy. You guys know a whole lot more than you'll say out loud. I'll tell you that. It's a good group here. Now, you could take a Nazarite vow. It wasn't commanded. It's talked about in the Old Testament, in books of law, Numbers and Deuteronomy. But it's not commanded. The purpose of a Nazarite vow was a personal dedication for a period of time to God. It's kind of like where the idea now that's carried along that we can equate with that, and I don't think they came from that, was where, what are you going to give up for Lent? Okay. And because you give up, you know, I'm going to give up something I don't like, food-wise. But, you know, but if I gave up anything I'd like, I would equate that with, God, see how dedicated I am to you. But with Nazarite vow, these people really were that dedicated. It's like being so upset about something, you practice prayer and fasting, which is still valid today. God still honors that. And it's not that the lack of food is going to make you holier, but it is an expression of your dedication to God and reliance on God. Now, you could take a Nazarite vow for any undetermined length of time, except for Samuel, Samson, and John the Baptist. They were dedicated as Nazarites. What you couldn't do, you couldn't have anything that had anything to do with a grape. No wine, a grape. No wine, no wine vinegar. No grape seeds. No grape skins. No grape jelly and jam, which they didn't have back then, because I don't think they had pectin, so we never set up. You couldn't cut your hair, and during the whole time in a Nazarite vow, and it was allowed to cut your hair if it became so long and unmanageable, it became a real problem. So John the Baptist was a Nazarite from birth. I don't suppose that 30-some years later, when he's baptized in our Lord, that he has hair down to his ankles. But it was told that you could cut it off in a reasonable way, so it wasn't a nuisance anymore. Third thing was you couldn't approach a dead body. So, remember Samson? Remember the lion? Remember that story? What was there? A dead body. Okay. Now you see the reason behind these things. You know, even if you're, and it doesn't seem right, and Carol mentioned it, you know, as we were talking about, doesn't seem right, but if your family member dies, you don't go to the funeral if you're involved in a Nazarite vow, because you can't approach a dead body. It's not only a human body. Could be Ruth, could be your little dog at home. Could be a dead body's a dead body. Why God had it that way and why man interpreted it that way? Because God didn't give these rules. Jews gave these rules for the Nazarite vow.
But you said that wasn't Nazarene section,
sir. Nazarite. It's not Nazarene. I'm talking about Nazarene in a minute.
Oh, okay.
I'm trying to separate the two for you. You could take a Nazarite vow today, but you're locked in for life. Why? The only place you can finish your Nazarite vow is in the temple. There's no temple. What was Paul asked to do with the four guys? Go in and pay their temple tax so that they could fulfill their Nazarite vow and shave their heads. So we have no temple. We can never complete it. Not that I think it's carried out much today anyway. Okay, that's Nazarite. and all things Nazarene. Nazarene, sect of the Nazarenes. Well, we think of somebody that's called a Nazarene being from where?
Nazareth.
Okay. Not when you talk about the sect of the Nazarenes. The Nazarenes were Jews who claimed, look at these fingers up here, who claimed to have come to Christ and become Christians. However, they practiced their Judaism with all the fervor, adhering to all the laws and statutes that they had adhered to before they ever heard about Christianity, but they still claimed Christ and Christianity, which in reality, when you examine the sect of the Nazarenes, they had accepted Christianity. They were no longer Jews. But being practicing Christians, I'm not saying born-again Christians, saying Christians, they were no longer Jews, but being Jews, they were no longer Christians. They really weren't anything. But they were a bunch of problems. Do you think a bunch of Jews, former Jews, or actually, as we understand it, current Jews, who accepted Christianity would be welcomed much by the Jewish community? Do you think that Christians who were still practicing every little tiny bit of the law and its rituals and its sacrifices and everything would be well accepted by the Christians? See, they're a man without a country. They're neither Jews nor Christians. That's who the sect of the Nazarenes were, troublemakers. So Tertullus has it right there a little bit, because no matter where they went, there was always some opposition to them. That's all I can tell you about the sect of the Nazarenes.
I have a footnote in my Bible here that says Nazarene sect of Christianity.
Was a sect of Christianity? Yeah, it was. It was a Jewish sect of Christianity, but they weren't born again Christians. Okay? That's absolutely true. I look at footnotes, by the way, in your Bibles, in my Bible. I don't have footnotes in my Bible for the most part. I look at them with a lot of skepticism, and I find a lot of them I don't agree with, and that's just me. But for a large part, 90-some percent of what you have is footnotes or helps.
It helps.
Great. Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. If I had any in mind, as I taught, it would only confuse me. So we'll go from there. Yes. Yes, and they used to be known as Pilgrim Holiness. They changed that to Holiness Church. But in reality, their old name was the Church of the Nazarene. And some still use that Church of the Nazarene as their designation. But it doesn't mean what the sect of the Nazarenes are.
They're different.
Okay? Good point, though.
I think the Nazarenes are broken off from Methodists.
Yeah, just like Assembly God is broken off from Baptists. They're charismatic Baptists. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all kinds of breaks there. Now he says that Paul was such a problem, he had to be seized and brought in. And you know, Ananias knows the story. And he hasn't said anything. He just brought the lawyer with him and some Jews, and that was it. Who would Felix believe? Would he believe Claudius Lysias? He might, because Claudius Lysias, remember, he was the Roman governor that took his army down and saved Paul from the crowd as they were trying to tear him in pieces and kill him? Claudius Lysias probably knew what was going on pretty well. He could find no Roman charge to bring against Paul. And you know, he fretted about that because he couldn't find any official charge. And when he found out that Paul was a Roman citizen, he had to bring a charge. What does he do? Ship him off. Get him out of here. Send him over to Felix. See what happens. Claudius Lysias probably knows a little bit more about the story than anybody except Paul. Do you see Claudius Lysias mentioned here?
No.
And Josephus, which is a historian and a contemporary of what's going on right here, tells us that Claudius Lysias didn't appear in Caesarea for the whole 2 years that Paul was in Caesarea. Stay back, stay out of the spotlight, don't let anybody see me, nobody will ask me any questions, so I won't have to tell any lies. So whether or not, we know Paul was in Caesarea for about 2 years, whether or not Claudius Lysias ever came there, we don't have any biblical reference to that, but Josephus is a very good, accurate historian. And don't be afraid when you see references to the book of Josephus. It's good history, and you can read it. You're not like going to be anathema because you read anything from Josephus. 10 through 21. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense." Does Paul butter him up the way Tertullus does? Is there any kind of commendation there? And you've done a really good job? No, he's stating a fact. You've been running this place for quite a while, and here I am to talk to you. No flattery, no words that would try to sway Felix at all.
I guess I'm saying I'll try to be brief either.
No. Verse 11, "You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up from Jerusalem to worship." That's 12 days minus the 5 days of verse 1 gives you 7 days that Paul was actually out and about. You can't accomplish a lot. Could you lead an insurrection in courthouse in 7 days? No. First of all, nobody in courthouse will believe me and listen to me anyway, except you guys. So, like, it's kind of hard to get a major uproar started in 7 days. You need time to work on it and build it up. Get people on your side. "My accusers," verse 12, "did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up the crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city." Why was Paul in a synagogue? In the temple? He always went there, but he wasn't preaching. Remember why he was there? There were four men completing what? The Nazarite vow. So he was there in the temple. Now, to be in the temple, did he have to ritually purify himself? Oh, yeah. So did he profane the temple? Not so far, did he? "They didn't find me stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city." And what that means, what Paul's saying there, is he really didn't preach in the temple or the synagogues or even in the city in that 7 short days, because he was involved for some of it in the temple with the four men completing their vow. "And they cannot prove to you the charges they now have been making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way." The way is Christianity, your early word for Christianity, "which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that it is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man." Without any religious background, without any religiosity, if you've never heard of God, and you do something bad, immoral, do you know it? Yeah, you do. Your conscience. Every man's born with a conscience. What is that conscience for? You know what that conscience is for? Is that there's going to be judgment. You might not know about judgment. You might not know about God. You might not know about rules and regulations that determine sociological behavior or spiritual behavior, but when you do something that's immoral, not necessarily illegal, immoral, your conscience lets you know that. And that conscience is a witness that someday there's a price to pay. So when Paul is talking about the resurrection, it's something everybody's familiar with, even though the Sadducees discount it. They willingly have ignorance in that. And willful ignorance you can hear about Tuesday evening if you go to the Christian school and listen to the debate between Ham and the village idiot that's going to debate him. He is in willful ignorance because no one that's can think rationally could believe in something as preposterous as evolution. It takes much more faith to believe evolution than it does creation. Go on. So we're in 17, and after an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people, gifts for the poor and to present offerings. His offerings were in there too. He's not just saying he collected all this from somebody else. The words here, my offerings, or the offerings, are also my offerings. Paul also contributed to this. Paul wasn't a rich guy. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. In Roman law, as in U.S. law, if there's no accusers, then what has to happen? The charges have to be dropped. You get a speeding ticket. You get a municipal court. Charges are read against you. If the cop's not there, you get the old wave goodbye. Don't count on that day. Because the cop may be there just for you. Okay? So we can't make a rule out of that. So what's happening? Well, there's no accusers. Just Tertullus. And he doesn't know anything about it except for what Ananias told him. He goes on to say, verse 20, or those who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. That's the Pharisees, Sadducees, and high priests. Unless it was one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence, it is concerning the resurrection of the dead, that I am on trial before you today. Felix, although he should, as a Roman, he don't care if Paul believes in the resurrection of the dead or not. He don't care anything about anything like that. To him, this is just Jewish nonsense. This is a debate about Jewish customs and rituals and law, and it really doesn't affect the Roman Empire at all. However, one thing, if you look back in history, one thing that was affecting the Roman Empire, and it's partly true what Paul is saying here, or what the Tertullus is saying here, there were so many Jewish people, Jewish by religion, that can be those who were drawn near, that can be proselytic people, became Jews, it can be Jews. So many of them were responding to the gospel of Jesus Christ being preached all throughout Asia, all throughout this area of Europe, both sides of the Aegean Sea, over across the Adriatic Sea, all around up to the Black Sea. There were so many Jews defecting from Judaism that the Romans were starting to figure out that this is not, and the word that's used here, that Christianity isn't really a sect of Judaism. And they sensed there was going to be a problem. Because now they had a competing religion. They had a religion that was not authorized by the state, like Judaism was. So there's a whole bunch of things happening in the background here. Now we have to keep in mind why certain people say certain things. Paul gave faithful answers. He didn't lie. He wanted to know where his accusers were. They were nowhere to be found. And instead of a fair hearing before the Sanhedrin and the high priest, what did Paul receive? Remember when he was standing before the Sanhedrin? Finally, he had to kind of get them to take sides and got them split up and everything. Paul stood up for the resurrection. And that upset a lot of the people that were there. Well, what really was going to be a problem here is Ananias, a hired lawyer, Tertullus, are stating one case against Paul. Paul sticking up for himself, very, very nicely, thank you. But who is Felix? What nationality? Roman. We're going to find out that racial prejudice plays a part in this as we go along into chapters 25 and 26. There's racial prejudice even back here. The Roman, all he knows right now, Felix, all he knows right now is a lot of his valuable time and, you know, his thought process or whatever he values as good for him is being taken up by these stupid Jews. And I'm saying it as Felix would have said it. I would never say anything against Jewish people. Yes? Not Felix, it's Festus's. We're going to read about him next week. Okay? So I know you feel about this, but don't let it fester.
Oh,
hey, come on, we're allowed to laugh, aren't we? Huh? We're all brothers and sisters in this. Oh, his wife was a Jew too, yeah. Okay, I didn't understand what you were exactly saying, yeah. Her name was Drusilla. Yeah, Drusilla. We're going to read about her sister and her brother next week. Okay? Felix couldn't plead ignorance to the facts. He knew a lot about Judaism, and I apologize because I answered a question that I didn't really understand, but I didn't know I didn't understand. Does that make any sense? His wife, Drusilla, was a Jewess. She's related to the Herods. How then was she a Jew?
Who knows?
I do.
Oh, good.
Who did the Herods descend from? Who did the Herods descend from? First man on the scene. That should give you a hint. First man on the scene, born a little bit before his brother. His lying, cheating, stealing brother.
Oh.
Esau. Esau is the father of whom? Edomites. Okay, Edom means red. You remember when Esau was born, he was at a red complexion? Okay. As the Edomites came down in generations, they became the Herods, some of them. Herod is a title. They're Edomites. How then are they Jews? Well, wasn't Esau's parents both Jewish? Wasn't Esau a genuine Jew? I mean, he forsook everything that was holy, so to speak, but he was just as Jewish as his brother, wasn't he? Yeah, so that's how Drusilla is a Jewess. She's a descendant of the Herods. Let me give you a couple of things about her. In Matthew 2, her great-grandfather tried to kill Jesus in Bethlehem. Remember him? Herod the Great. Herod the Great, the one that rebuilt the Jewish temple. Why would a Herod rebuild the temple? He's a Jew. So that's why. Her great uncle killed John the Baptist and mocked Jesus. That's in Luke 23. Yeah. And her father killed the Apostle James. Acts 12, 1 and 2. That was Herod Agrippa. So it was her father was Herod Agrippa. By the way, I find it very interesting that after that Herod Antipas had John beheaded, worms ate him up from the inside out. Seems only fitting. Huh? I like that part. So we know we've got a good family going here. Drusilla. She was betrothed by her father to some male when she was six. But she never, they had to wait till they were 14 to get married. But this person that her father betrothed her to, you know, you didn't get to pick your husband back then. You were issued one, kind of like the army. But her intended wouldn't become a Jew, wouldn't participate in the Jewish rites. So at 14, she married this other guy. And he said he'd become a Jew. He was circumcised. He had all the Jewish rites done and everything, but never really practiced them. And then along comes Felix when she's about 22 and says, what a fox. She's going to be mine. Felix takes her away from her husband and takes her to be his wife. Totally illegal. She's a Jewess. How can you get out of marriage as a Jew? If your partner is unfaithful to you, immorally and sexually, or they die. That's the only way you can get out of marriage. Drusilla now is living in sin. Just take 2 minutes. We're going to see what happens. Several days later in verse 24, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke the faith about Christ Jesus. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, and a better translation there, I think, is actually how King James says it. It says, Felix trembled. Has anyone here ever been afraid? Have you ever been so afraid you trembled? See, it's like one step up a bit about being afraid. Felix trembled, and that's an accurate translation here. Why did he tremble? Well, you know, he took another man's wife. He's living in sin. And there's judgment coming. So what is Paul reminding him of? He says, Paul discoursed on righteousness. Was Felix living a righteous life, him and his wife Drusilla? No. He tells him about self-control. Were they living celibate? I doubt it. There's no self-control there. Even Felix didn't display self-control when he took another man's wife in his lust. And then the big one is the judgment to come. Felix is saying to himself, I've been bad, I know I've been bad, and I'm going to get punished for being bad. He knows that. That's why he's trembling. He knows there's judgment to come. He's got a Jewish wife. He knows all these things about God. What does he say? That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I'll send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe so that he sent him frequently and talked to him. You know, if Paul had offered a bribe, Felix probably would have let him go because there was no Roman rules that were broken here. This was a religious debate. But Paul, I don't know, didn't offer a bribe. Broke Felix's heart. You know, Paul probably gave everything he had in the offering to the saints in Jerusalem when he was in the temple.
He wouldn't have given a bribe anyhow.
He wouldn't have given a bribe anyway. So, think about this. At the verse 27, for 2 years, when 2 years had passed, see, Paul's been in Caesarea for 2 years, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. If when Felix, he had an ulterior motive of getting a bride, but he called for Paul many times over 2 years to discuss things with him. And I have a feeling that Drusilla went along, and Drusilla was a problem. Because I think Felix, based on what we're seeing here, he hasn't fallen for the flattery and all that. I really don't believe it. If Drusilla hadn't been with him, he may have listened Paul out and become saved. But his wife became a stumbling block because of her great sin. Who knows? That's just hypothesizing. At any rate, we're going to find out about a new guy next week. Porcius Festus. He takes over for Felix. We're going to find out who comes to him. It's Herod II and Drusilla's sister. Mm-hmm.